This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, March 19, 2002. I'm Nell Abram. The UN Secretary General calls Israel's offensive in the occupied territories all-out conventional warfare. The Commonwealth suspended Zimbabwe for 1 year, calling the electoral process there seriously flawed. And police arrest the alleged architect of arson in the train massacre in western India. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Pentagon officials support the sale of a $1.2 million missile system by a contractor with ties to the administration, despite concerns by others that the sale could destabilize Asia. Josh Chaffin reports from D.C.
The Pentagon says the sale of the Aegis missile system to South Korea would contribute to the national security of the United States. But the sale would likely rile the communist regime of North Korea. Wade Bays with the Arms Control Association says the sale wouldn't start a war between the two Koreas, but it could open the door to the U.S. selling the same system to Taiwan.
And that could be very troubling for the region in general, because China would perceive that as a possible threat to its interests. It could suggest a spiraling technological race or arms race.
The Aegis missile system is built by Lockheed Martin, where the vice president's wife, Lynn Cheney, was a board member. The deputy director of President Bush's National Security Council was an attorney for Lockheed Martin. And the president's pick for Undersecretary of the Air Force was a Lockheed Martin vice president. One senior Lockheed Martin official told reporters last year he wrote the Republican Party's foreign policy platform. Joshua Chaffin, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court considered whether public schools can arbitrarily mandate drug testing of students who want to participate in after-school programs. Gareth Schweitzer has more from the court.
Lindsay Earle's lawsuit challenges her Oklahoma school district's policy of randomly drug testing students involved in after-school activities. Parents whose children had died due to drug overdoses joined with school board members outside the courthouse today to defend the Board of Education's decision. But Graham Boyd, an American Civil Liberties Union lawyer representing Earls, argued today that the courts had only upheld drug testing in cases where either a student was strongly suspected of using drugs or a group of students was suffering an epidemic of drug use, both precedents which he believes are not applicable to this case.
There's no drug use going on in the activities that's been documented. There's very little drug use in the school, probably one-tenth what's being done on the national level. And there's nothing dangerous about these activities. So all the reasons that courts have given for drug testing in the past are absent here.
Boyd also pointed out that most drug use by students occurs in the hours right after school, when students have the opportunity to participate in the programs currently in question. At the Supreme Court, I'm Gareth Schweitzer for Free Speech Radio News.
Today is the last day of winter and the warmest on record in the northeastern United States. And in the southern hemisphere, scientists who study snow and ice said a massive section of the Antarctic ice sheet collapsed. Nell Geiser reports from Boulder, Colorado.
After warnings from scientists in England, Argentina, and the United States about the precarious position of the Larsen B ice shelf, the University of Colorado-based Snow and Ice Data Center announced today that the shelf collapsed over a 35-day period into thousands of icebergs. Caused by rising temperatures, the event was the largest of its kind in 30 years and leaves the shelf at only 40% of its previous size. The rate of warming in the region since the 1940s has been 32.9 degrees Fahrenheit.
The warm-up and the response that we're seeing is unprecedented, that we haven't seen these ice shelves disappear in the last few thousand years.
Ted Scambos of the Snow and Ice Data Center says the collapse may be related to global warming, but it's hard to pin down.
Climate hasn't been this warm in the peninsula in the last several thousand years. Now, what's the cause of it? Well, we can sort of see that there's been a change in how often certain air patterns set up over the Antarctic Peninsula. But what's the cause of that? It's sort of a little more uncertain.
The breakoff could eventually impact sea levels and is part of a larger trend of ice melt. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Geiser in Boulder, Colorado.
And finally, the state of South Carolina is suing the NAACP for demonstrating at highway rest stops. The suit brought by the state attorney general Charlie Condon claims highway rest stops are protected from group gatherings by state and federal law. At a press conference announcing the suit, Condon said, "Next, we may see labor unions protesting our right to work laws with a Green Party telling visitors our state is insensitive to the environment, or PETA activists complaining about animal rights. The NAACP conducts what they call border patrols at South Carolina rest stops to tell people about their boycott of the state as long as the Confederate flag continues to be flown on State House grounds. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan accused Israel of waging all-out war against the Palestinians. Susan Wood reports from the United Nations.
In an unusually blunt letter to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, Annan described as illegitimate Israel's use of heavy weaponry, including F-16 fighter bombers and helicopter gunships, against civilian targets in the West Bank and Gaza. The letter, leaked to the media yesterday, was sent on March 12th, the day Annan addressed harsh criticism of Israel to the UN Security Council.
The International Committee of Red Cross and other agencies are reporting growing disregard on the part of the Israeli Defense Forces for the safety of medical and ambulance personnel who are attempting to treat and evacuate the wounded from conflict zones. Only last week, a UN staff member was killed in a clearly marked UNRWA ambulance.
The UN chief also condemned Palestinian militants' Qassam 2 rocket launches and suicide attacks against Israeli civilians. That night, the Security Council passed a U.S.-sponsored resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire and for the first time endorsing a Palestinian state. Through a spokesperson today, Annan deplored the human cost of the Arab-Israeli conflict and urged both sides to return to the negotiating table. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Vice President Dick Cheney met with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon today. Sharon softened a number of his positions before and during Cheney's visit. He pulled Israeli troops out of Palestinian-run areas, dropped his demand for 7 days of absolute calm before the truce, and raised the prospect of PLO leader Yasser Arafat traveling abroad. Cheney offered to meet with Arafat if decisive steps are taken to comply with the ceasefire proposals put forth last June by CIA Chief George Tenet and end Palestinian attacks on Israelis by the end of the week.
I am hopeful that the effort that we're making here today in order to move forward to achieve the objective of the full implementation of Tenet. If there is implementation of Tenet, then I have agreed to make a trip to a location in the region yet to be determined, where I will in fact sit down with Chairman Arafat.
Cheney listed the steps he expects Arafat to take. He must speak to his own people personally about the importance of ending violence and terrorism, issue clear instructions to his security services to enforce the ceasefire, and follow up closely to ensure implementation of the work plan. A meeting with Cheney would mark Arafat's highest-level contact yet with the Bush administration. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Awad Duabes is in Ramallah and reports on Arafat's response.
Palestinian Authority welcomed the position of American Vice President Dick Cheney, considering it as a positive start in a possible change in the United States policy. Nabila Bordini, counselor of President Arafat, said that the possibility of a meeting between Cheney and President Arafat is a good step in the right direction, as he said, adding that the letter handed today to Arafat from Cheney by the American envoy, General Anthony Zinni, was positive, insisting on the application of CIA Chief George Tenet's plan for a truce and a ceasefire between both sides. In the same press conference with Dick Cheney, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon declared that Arafat might have the ability to leave the Palestinian territories, but if violence continues, Arafat will not be able to come back, added the Israeli Prime Minister. This position was considered as insufficient by Abu Dhabi, Palestinian leader counselor. Israel must implement Tenet's plan immediately and start negotiations, added the Palestinian official. On the other hand, Palestinians said the agreement reached with Israeli concerning the withdrawal of Israeli tanks from Palestinian-controlled area was not respected. Palestinian officials said this morning that such withdrawal was implemented only in the region of Bethlehem, while a new incursion took place in the northern of the Gaza Strip. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is having tonight a meeting with his cabinet to discuss these latest developments, while a Palestinian high-level team is in Cairo after a visit to Riyadh in order to finalize the Saudi proposal for peace so it can be approved by the Arab League summit due in Beirut at the end of this month. On the ground, a new attack took place in Jordan Valley this morning. Two Palestinians and one Israeli officer were killed. The attack, which was proclaimed by the Palestinian Islamic Movement Hamas, is the second one in the same region in 4 months. Israeli sources said attackers came from Jordanian borders, while Palestinian sources said the attack was aiming an Israeli military compound. A fourth victim was killed today, this time another Palestinian killed near Hebron, south of Jerusalem. Meanwhile, Israeli tanks are surrounding Palestinian villages and cities, and roads are closed in front of Palestinian population between those cities and villages, confirmed a Palestinian spokesman. And between international and American efforts to reach a ceasefire in one hand and Israeli and Palestinian positions on the other hand, in both sides, people are counting victims and wondering when they will be able to realize their inspirations, end of occupation and security. For Free Speech Radio, Awad Davis, Ramallah.
The Commonwealth has suspended Zimbabwe from the organization's councils for 1 year, meeting out one of the most serious sanctions the 54-nation organization can impose. Predominantly white members, like Britain and Australia, called for such stiff sanctions against the controversial President Robert Mugabe, while African countries like Nigeria and South Africa adopted a more conciliatory approach. Mugabe was re-elected after 3 days of polling. The opposition Movement for Democratic Change accuses him of stealing the election. Observers describe the elections as distinctly flawed. They returned to New York from Harare yesterday and provided a look at the process against a backdrop of continued colonialism. Dred Scott Keyes was there.
It was Blair's ancestors who colonized us here, exploited our land, exploited our people and turned us into slaves. And Blair wants to repeat what his ancestors did to us. We shall never allow him.
That was Robert Mugabe speaking at a campaign rally prior to his election as president last week. Mugabe heads up ZANU-PF, which led the national liberation struggle against the white minority regime of Ian Smith of what was then Rhodesia. In 1979, that fight led to what became known as the Lancaster Accords. These accords prevented the guerrillas of ZANU and ZAPU, the major liberation forces, from seizing and perhaps nationalizing much of the land in Zimbabwe. Today, the vast majority of the best land in the country is still owned and controlled by whites. Omawali Clay is a member of the December 12th coalition and was part of a delegation invited to Zimbabwe to act as observers. He says the Lancaster Accord, signed between the British and the guerrilla movements, has led to the present impasse between the Commonwealth and developing nations like Zimbabwe.
It was a compromise, and we should be very clear. They did not fight all the way through to seize all of the means of production in Zimbabwe. And in fact, for the first 10 years after Lancaster, their constitution was in place that in fact set in place a permanent representation during those 10 years of white folks who, just by the fact they were white, had a certain amount of representation. Also during that time, they were strapped with the premise that land could not exchange hands only on the principle of willing buyer, willing seller. So for 10 years after Lancaster, you know, when people want to talk about, well, why didn't they return the land? The bottom line was there was a compromise, and that is the reflection of that compromise. Secondly, and very importantly, is the fact that after those 10 years, that Britain and the United States made a commitment to compensate the white farmers in Zimbabwe. Britain started heeing and hawing, and President Carter, and Andrew Young is very clear about this. If you remember, he was ambassador to the United Nations, and he speaks very clear about this point, that the United States and Britain reneged on compensation to the white farmers.
According to Clay, the opposition party led by Morgan Tsvangirai and the Movement for Democratic Change emerged out of Zimbabwe's trade union movement but has evolved into something else.
The main funding of NDC came from a trust fund from England, and it had been very early on looked at as a way to form an opposition against Mugabe. So the purse strings of MDC was really what always controlled its ideological development in terms of that. And there were many power struggles inside that, but the bottom line was it really represented British financial interests and banking interests in particular, and also the commercial white farmers.
When veterans of the guerrilla war began occupying farmland owned by whites 2 years ago, with President Mugabe's endorsement, the Western media, particularly the BBC, began to criticize the government of Mugabe. He then accused the media outlet of being biased, uninformed, and a tool of the British government. Dave Daniels was another observer to the election and says the demonization of Mugabe and the characterization of the elections as flawed and besieged with violence was for two reasons.
One, it's to build support internationally for economic terrorism against Zimbabwe, because England knew and knows it could not win, it could not defeat the people's desire to re-elect their own president. And two, it is to create the environment for covert action. And that's very significant. It's very significant because we know that the enemy does not give up, that they lost in the ballot box. So the role of the media is to hopefully put in people's mind in the United Nations to say, well, look, this was unfair, this was flawed. So therefore, you know, we will support the United States through its various mechanisms going into Zimbabwe.
Meanwhile, in London today, Tsvangirai has rejected talks with Mugabe for a government of national unity. There's no question that the implications for land reform throughout Southern Africa, especially with South Africa, has perked the ears of global powers and has called into question the role of the Commonwealth and whether it is a relic of colonialism or a mechanism for real change in the context of developing nations. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
Police in India arrested the man they believe planned last month's arson attack by Muslims on a train in which 58 Hindu activists were killed. The attack sparked widespread riots in the western Indian state of Gujarat. Even as fires continue to burn in the region, the country's labor movements are coming together to challenge the government's privatization program and propose changes to labor laws. Tens of thousands of people demonstrated last week in Bombay and Delhi to express their opposition. Thursday's long march also targeted the divide-and-rule tactic on the basis of caste and religion that's taking a bloody toll in India. More from Sputnik Kalambi.
There were over 60,000 in India's commercial capital Bombay last week, and tens of thousands more in Delhi and other cities across the country. People from the organized and unorganized sectors, from dock workers to teachers, were out in force, shouting their anger at a government they say is succumbing to pressure from international financial institutions and industrialists at home. The proposed changes to labor laws will allow companies with less than 1,000 workers to hire and fire at will, a policy that spells doom in a country where small-scale enterprises are the rule rather than the exception. If pushed through, the changes will mean huge layoffs in the vulnerable unorganized sector. Massive job cuts are also feared as a result of the government's drive to privatize even profit-making public sector companies.
Industrialists are lobbying to introduce this law. They wanted to crush the trade union movement in India.
This is to show the strength of the workers, which are against the policies of the government. All the working class from all the organizations, people from all the organizations are here.
No sector is exempt from the government's anti-people policies, says M. Sadashivan of the Bombay University and College Teachers Union. Teachers, he says, are as affected as the working class.
Teachers' union are faced with the same problem of closure of colleges, non-payment of salaries. Teachers have not received salary in Maharashtra for the last definitely 2 months. All the colleges, and some of them have not received salary for even 8 to 9 months. And they are fighting a big battle at their respective management level. Hire and fire is taking place. For the first time, teachers are being appointed on clock hour basis, which means just pay them 80 rupees per lecture without vacation, without provident fund, without gratuity, without any pension, without any future.
A majority of the country's 28 million working class works in the public sector, and they will be hit hard by the tidal wave of privatization currently underway. Under the guise of liberalizing the labor market, says Vivek Montero of the Red Flag Union C2, the entire country is up for sale.
Mines, the banks, insurance, the energy sector, petroleum, not just institutions, but entire sectors of the economy. There is evidently a huge amount of corruption which is involved in this process. Important assets of the country are being sold for a song on the record. So it's obvious that there's very large off-the-record transactions. And this government is known for its record-breaking corruption scams.
The current economic policies will inevitably lead to increased state brutality and attempts to divide and rule by playing the caste or religious card, says Professor Hargopal of Hyderabad Central University. The withdrawal of government from the welfare domain has serious consequences for a country like India, he says. The state derives its legitimacy not just from elections, but from its role in the economy.
That is the implication of the disinvestment. It's not merely a management of the economy, but what will be the human face of the state if they withdraw from all these activities, except managing the law and order and managing the territory, you know, through a war. What else the government can do? And in popular perception, in an ordinary poor man's perception, an unemployed young man's perception, government is there just to maintain the order, not even law.
Ironically, unions linked to the Hindu right are also against the BJP's economic policies. Moreover, the communal carnage in Gujarat, one of India's most industrialized states, still recovering from last year's devastating earthquake, will certainly deter investors, especially from abroad, that this government is desperately trying to woo. And adds Professor Hargopal, the BJP is caught in its own bind by trying to wed its version of Hindu culture and Western economics.
Now, on the one hand, they're going for globalization, westernization, being a part of the global power. And on the other hand, whatever they have built during the last 70 years, they are not able to convince their cadre. So therefore, the Hindu revivalism, in a way, is necessary, partly because that's only the social base. There is no economic agenda which can convince the people that here is a meaningful government to know which can solve their problems. So therefore, I think Hindu revivalism for electoral politics, globalization for economic power or economic management. Therefore, they're caught in the contradiction.
Labor unions say they will maintain the pressure. A total shutdown of the public sector is expected on April the 16th. I'm Sputnik Kilambi in Bombay for Free Speech Radio News.
The United Nations Security Council issued a report acknowledging civilians more frequently bear the brunt of modern warfare than combatants do, and adopted new guidelines designed to help deliberations on the protection of non-combatants. The document also recognizes the impact of wartime hardships borne by civilians on any effort to achieve durable peace, reconciliation, and development. UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs Kenzo Oshima stressed the importance of decisive and timely action to end the suffering of millions of innocent victims of warfare, including women and children. He cited Sudan as an example, saying that the international community is dismayed by the recent pattern of attacks on civilians, humanitarian workers, and facilities there. As Rupert Cook reports, the civilians of Sudan also face the strife and catastrophe caused by the discovery of oil.
Well, I'm just outside the church in Magang. The church is really just an enclosure. It's fenced off with some grass walls about 7 feet tall, held together by some type of plant twine. There are around 150-odd people in the church. This community is Dinka, so it's an SPLA area, and much of the service today has been focused on the need for peace. Southern Sudan is one of the least developed regions in the world. There are no roads and virtually no mechanized vehicles. In Sobat County, not far from the front lines, in the almost 20-year war between the predominantly Christian Southern Sudanese rebels and the radical Islamist government, there are no schools and only one tiny health clinic for hundreds of thousands of people. Yet, not far from the church in Magang, just a few days' journey along the Nile, Foreign oil companies are hard at work, drilling and installing pipelines to transport the extracted oil to a refinery in the north of the country. According to international NGO Christian Aid, the Sudanese government makes $1 million a day from the oil fields of the Upper Nile. Most of the revenue is spent on arms. Perhaps not surprisingly, oil has become a major factor in Sudan's civil war. Niang Chol is a senior official with RAS, the humanitarian wing of the rebel SPDF faction.
People are fighting over the exploitation of oil, and the oil field has become the center of conflict. Rebel forces are fighting in order to close down the oil fields, and the government is fighting, doing its utmost best to extract the oil in order to sponsor their war effort. People are displaced, are removed by force by the government in order to extract oil. And from time it is a conflict zone. Most of the people either they go very far, especially in Western Upper Nile. People are displaced, they go to their neighbor. The government doesn't allow them to stay peaceful. They actually bombard them. High altitude bombing displaced people, of course, not the military target. So people are suffering.
The extraction of oil in the Upper Nile region of southern Sudan has been a major factor in the massive human rights abuses suffered by the civilian population. Leslie Levko is a human rights specialist with international NGO Dutch Doctors Without Borders.
In 1997, the area started going up in flames and has basically been in flames ever since. That happens to coincide with the oil development. The conflict, especially in Western Upper Nile in recent years, has become more brutal. In previous years, there would be soldiers around, and sometimes they would get looted, but the people themselves were not hurt, and crucially, the cows were not raided. And many people said that this changed in the last few years, and that we clearly do see that there was a marked change in the environment when oil development began.
While the southern Sudanese are especially indignant about what they allege to be the complicity of Canadian oil conglomerate Talisman in frequently corroborated human rights abuses perpetrated by the Sudanese government forces, there are mixed feelings about the oil. For many southern Sudanese, oil represents the only possibility of wealth and development for a country which lags years behind its neighbours. Yet, people also recognise that oil makes the resolution of the conflict that much more distant. With more than $350 million in annual revenue at stake, it's unlikely that the government will acquiesce to ceding control over the oil fields. Moloch Ringkur is a senior commander with the SPLA in the Upper Nile region of southern Sudan.
Oil is a major problem these days. The Sudanese government transports its oil to foreign countries so it can go and buy a lot of things for military needs, equipment and so forth. How can the war end that way? The war cannot end today or tomorrow. If the international community says that there should be a ceasefire, the Sudanese government will violate that ceasefire. It's because they depend on oil. They know that they can bring everything from outside. They consider themselves more powerful than us, and they think that they will be able to defeat us. It's part of their project of Islamization. They want to Islamize the southerners.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Megang, southern Sudan.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Nell Abrams.